Right, okay. This is about Trotsky. This class will deal with Trotsky on the Revolution Betrayed, Chapter 5, Part 3. The chapter is called The Soviet Thermidor, and the little passage or the part of it that we're dealing with is the concluding part, which is the concluding part of the fifth chapter. It's called The Social Roots of Thermidor. And it really is a significant building block in Trotsky's theoretical understanding of the growth of inequality and the degeneration of the revolution in the period we're talking about, which is the mid-30s, really. And what he's trying to address is the what he calls the deep social causes of the rise of the bureaucracy and its representatives to supreme power in the workers' states. To get down to fundamentals and not be sidetracked by superficial or incidental aspects of the situation. So he wrote by analogy. He made a point about analogies with the French Revolution, and he wrote that. And I'll quote him. He says that the victory of the Thermidorians over the Jacobins in the 18th century was also aided by the weariness of the masses and the demoralization of the leading cadre. But beneath these essentially incidental phenomena, a deep organic process was taking place. The Jacobins rested upon the lower petty bourgeoisie, lifted by the great wave. The revolution of the 18th century, however, corresponding to the course of development of the productive forces, could not but bring the great bourgeoisie to political ascendancy in the long run. The Thermidor was only one of the stages of this in this inevitable process. What si similar social necessity found expression in the Soviet Thermidor? We've tried already to, in one of the preceding chapters, to make a preliminary answer to the question of why the gendarme triumphed. We must now prolong out the analysis of the conditions of the transition from capitalism to socialism, and the role of the state in this process. So what he's saying is that if the French Revolution could not but bring the great bourgeoisie to political ascendancy in the long run, as the outcome of a bourgeois revolution, what ultimately explained the eclipse of the radical forces in the Russian Revolution? What then was the explanation for the Soviet Thermidor? And that's what this section attempts to explain. And Trotsky takes one of Lenin's most fundamental points about the nature of a workers' state, as opposed to any other type of class state, as a starting point of his analysis. And he says that he notes that he quotes that Lenin as saying that it's still necessary to suppress the bourgeoisie and its resistance. But the organ of suppression here now is the majority of the population, and not the minority, as had heretofore always been the case. In that sense, the state is beginning to die away. And again, he quotes Lenin on the consequences of that. He says that Lenin is saying that the more universal becomes the fulfillment of the functions of the state power, the less need there is of this power. And then Trotsky himself draws out the programmatic norms that Lenin was discussing. And he says that for Lenin, the dying away of the state then begins on the very day after the expropriation of the expropriators. But then he makes a point that somewhat qualifies that, because he notes that prognosis takes place before the question of quoting again, before the new regime has had time to take up its economic and cultural problems. So, and he goes on to extrapolate the consequences of this and the paradox of the reality that he's discussing. So just quoting again a passage where he says that every success in the solution of these problems means a further step in the liquidation of the state, its dissolution in the socialist society. The degree of this dissolution is the best defense of of the depth and efficacy of the socialist structure. We may lay down approximately this sociological theorem. The strength of the compulsion exercised by the masses in a workers' state is directly proportional to the strength of the exploitative tendencies, or the danger of a restoration of capitalism, and inversely proportional to the strength of the social solidarity and the general loyalty to the new regime. Thus, the bureaucracy, that is, as they say, the privileged officials and commanders of the standing army, represents a special kind of compulsion which the masses cannot or do not wish to exercise, and which, one way or another, is directed against the masses themselves. And that's the point. The activity of the bureaucracy is itself directed against the masses themselves. And he notes about the form that it took, i.e. that quoting again, he says, the mass Soviets have entirely disappeared from the scene, having turned over the function of compulsion to Stalin, Yagoda, and company. And what forms of compulsion? He's talking about the extreme nature of the compulsion that these people exercised. And he asks the question of why this happens, in essence. So he says, first of all, we must ask ourselves, what social cause stands behind its politicization? The importance of this question is obvious. In dependence upon the answer, we must either radically revise our traditional views of socialist society in general, or as radically reject the official estimates of the Soviet Union. But by way of a preliminary to the explanation, he manages to completely ridicule the theoretical answer and the structure given by Molotov, who's one of Stalin's close confederates, who attempted to excuse the monstrous growth of the repressive apparatus in the state in this period. So Molotov boasted that the national economy of the country has become socialistic. And in that sense, we've solved the problem of the liquidation of classes. But then he continued that there remain, quoting again, elements in their nature hostile to us, petty speculators, grafters in relation to the collective and state wealth, anti-Soviet gossips, etc. And then Molotov, as cited by Trotsky, is paraphrased as saying that in opposition to Engels, the worker state must not fall asleep, but on the contrary, become more and more vigilant. So what Trotsky does is he points out the contradiction, the self-contradiction in this, by going back to Lenin. And he quotes Lenin again, saying, we are not utopians. We by no means deny the possibility and inevitability of excesses on the part of the individual persons, and likewise the necessity for suppressing such excesses. But for this, there is no need of a special machine, a special apparatus of repression. This will be done by the armed people themselves, with the same simplicity and ease with which any crowd of civilized people, even in contemporary society, separate a couple of fighters or stop an act of violence against a woman, etc. And what he's demonstrating is that Molotov is the only individual in the Stalinist regime who'd even attempted to justify the growth of a repressive state in theoretical terms, and is all his points completely answered in advance by Lenin many years earlier. So that's an important point. And just continuing the analysis, Trotsky is really asking the question about what is the explanation of the monstrous growth of the bureaucratic and repressive state apparatus. And the bureaucracy cannot explain it without falling into severe self-contradiction. And yet there was actually a clear objective cause for it. And just quoting him directly again, he says, the present Soviet society cannot get along without a state, nor even within limits without a bureaucracy. But in the case of this, is by no means the pitiful remains of the past, but the mighty forces and tendencies of the present. The justification for the existence of a Soviet state as an apparatus of compulsion lies in the fact that the present transitional structure is still full of social contradictions, which in the sphere of consumption, most close and sensitively felt by all, are extremely tense and forever threaten to break over into the sphere of production. The triumph of socialism cannot be called either final or irrevocable. And he goes on to elaborate the material roots of this and the basic necessity that gives rise to the core elements of the mechanism. So he writes again that, quoting again, that the basis of bureaucratic rule is in the poverty of society and objects of consumption, with the resulting struggle of each against all. When there are enough goods in a store, the purchasers can come and buy whatever they want to, come wherever they want to. When there are little goods, the purchasers are compelled to stand in line. When the lines are very long, it's necessary to appoint a policeman to keep order. And that's the starting point of the power of the Soviet bureaucracy. It knows who is to get something and who has to wait. So, in fact, he noted that the very growth of the productive forces from the initially very low level had helped fuel the growth of the bureaucracy. Because he's a super, yeah. Looking at it superficially, quoting again, he said he posits that a raising of the material and cultural level ought, at first glance, to lessen the necessity of privileges, narrow the sphere of application of bourgeois law, and thereby undermine the standing ground of its defenders, the bureaucracy. In reality, the opposite thing has happened. The growth of the productive forces has been so far accompanied by an extreme development of all forms of inequality, privilege, and advantage, and therewith of bureaucratism. That too is not accidental. And so, this is in itself the product of the growth of the economy from the state of near total exhaustion that prevailed at the end of the Civil War in 1921. So Trotsky narrates what actually happened. He says that in its first period, the Soviet regime was undoubtedly far more equalitarian and less bureaucratic than it is now. But that was an equality of general poverty. The resources of the country were so scant that there was no opportunity to separate out from the masses of the population any broad privileged state strata. Soviet economy had to lift itself from its poverty to a somewhat higher level before fat deposits of privilege became possible. The present state of production is still far from guaranteeing all necessities to everybody, but it's already adequate to give significant privileges to a minority and to convert inequality into a whip for the spurring on of the majority. That is the first reason why the growth of production has so far strengthened not the socialist, but the bourgeois features of the state. So he notes that the objective necessity of the existence of a bureaucracy, this as discussed earlier, because of the need to maintain inequality in order that the regime could maintain bourgeois right in the transition to the lower phase of communism, as we've explained before. We talked about this previously. As Marx himself noted, if we recall what we discussed, that such distribution required an apparatus of coercion, what he called even a bourgeois state without the bourgeoisie. That was the phenomenon that gave rise to the growth of the Soviet bureaucracy in the first place. And the bureaucracy was able to act as a self-motivated actor in this situation, and thereby a danger to the survival of the revolution. And that's the key insight of this chapter, building on what we discussed before. But he writes that alongside the economic factor dictated capitalist methods of payment at the present stage, there operates a parallel political factor in the person of the bureaucracy itself. In its very essence, it is the planter and protector of inequality. It arose in the beginning as the bourgeois organ of a workers' state. in establishing and defending the advantages of a minority, it of course draws off the cream for its own use. No one who has wealth to distribute ever omits himself. Thus, out of a social necessity, there has developed an organ which has far outgrown its socially necessary function and become an independent factor, and therewith the source of great danger for the whole social organism. And he draws an operative conclusion from this. He says that, quoting again, he says, the social meaning of the Soviet Thermidor now begins to take form before us. The poverty and cultural backwardness of the masses has become incarnate in the malignant figure of the ruler with a great club in his hand. The deposed and abused bureaucracy, from being a servant of society, has again become its lord. On this road, it has attained such a degree of social and moral alienation from the popular masses that it cannot now permit any control over its activities or its income. So at the end, Trotsky hints at some remedies for this, at the potential remedy for it anyway, which we will actually discuss. Well, we'll discuss all this stuff in some more depth in the next chapter, in succeeding chapters, and no doubt. The conclusion he draws, which is this, he says, well, the first still very meagre wave of prosperity in the country, just because of its meagreness, has not weakened but strengthened these centrifugal tendencies. On the other hand, there has developed simultaneously a desire of the unprivileged to slap the grasping hands of the new gentry. The social struggle again grows sharp. Such are the sources of the power of the bureaucracy, but from also from those sources comes a threat to its power. And I'm going to leave it there because, you know, that is really the concluding point of the chapter in a way. We've discussed the other parts of the chapter in previous classes. I do think that there's a lot more material that goes into that, sort of elaborates this more in what's coming up in the book. And obviously, we're going to go over that in some depth as well. But I think that's quite, does provide a theoretical framework for understanding what's to come anyway. So I'll leave it there and open it up to discussion. Thank you, comrades. Cheers. Who wants to speak?
Right, I want to speak.
Yeah, fine, all right. Go ahead.
I think it is a fundamental chapter. Fundamental paragraph in the chapter 5,
mm-hmm.
In the sense that it explains to us why Thermidor, why was Thermidor, the Thermidor word, applicable to Russia, which in fact had been designed to explain the process in France. And the importance of doing this is to look at the process of history from the point of view that the evolution of society is determined in the end by the improvement in the capacity to produce, and the best improvement being when the capacity to produce is in the hand of society as a whole through nationalization, as opposed to each individual having a bit of it and everybody competing against the other. So the worker state was obviously superior in that sense because it became capable of planning production and assessing the need and then striving to produce according to needs, which was therefore possible because competition has been removed. And so therefore, the simple necessity is what should guide the policy. I think because this is important from the point of view of theory, the point of view of the way of thinking, so that with the concept of Thermidor, there was the idea that as the French Revolution retreated, it retreated, but it did not go back to feudalism. Why I didn't go back to feudalism, it's not because everybody had become enlightened, but because the productive forces and the social relations which derive from the improvement in the means of production was allowing a new form of state, a new form of society. And so however much there would be a retreat, they were not the material condition to go back to feudalism, because feudalism was completely incapable of dealing with the market, for example. And so it's important for us to see why is Trotsky applying this to this revolution, the revolution in Russia. Why is that? So he looks for the social meaning of the Soviet Thermidor. So for anybody who watches, they can see that tremendous backwardness continued, even though worker state was made. The poverty, he says, of poverty actually of goods, but the cultural backwardness, which is the basis of Russia in those days, all of that became incarnated, Trotsky says, in the malignant figure of the ruler with a great club in his hand. I mean, what more backward can you be? And yet, that was a state which, though it continued to have a state, as in private property, there was still a state. Even though the state continued, now there was. Like Ian said in the introduction, there was a progress. There was an improvement in this industrialization and in agriculture, in everywhere. There was an improvement. And so, since there was less shortage, the theory would have meant that less shortage means less dispute, and people there is less need of a gendarme to police the long queues of people if the queue is less long. But unfortunately, that did not happen and needed an explanation. All around me, as I was myself developing politically when I was young, the people around me would say, "Oh, the Soviet Union is no good. It has kept the state, and there is inequality, and people don't have. Still, there's a lot of shortages, and so all this would weigh on people who would just throw the worker state out in their view. The worker state would not be good because it had not been perfect." And so I think what this does here is to show us that one has to analyze in order not against the perfection idea, the ideal of what we wish, but against the difficulties which present themselves and how they are resolved. And in the end, the bureaucracy took over. But it is not a class, because it has had to make changes, continuously changes, and answer in order to justify itself, answer to the demand. And this is why there was an improvement in the means of production and in production itself in the Soviet Union after all these years which Trotsky describe. I would like to come back then to this question of the Thermidor, so that when there was in France a regression from liberty, equality, fraternity, which had been the hope of people, the hope of the revolutionaries, there's a retreat. Then, what is the threat in our retreat? The return to feudalism? There was no such threat, because feudalism was totally incapable to take back power in the conditions of reached at that point. And so what it could be then, it was an intermediate stage, which in which liberty, inequality remained. Now, if you apply that to the Soviet Union, when it retreats, when it retreated from the revolution, which had the hope for socialism, when it retreats, it is not just towards feudalism that it retreats. It is towards the bourgeois class, the bourgeois stage. And so for this revolution, the danger was double. This Thermidor was a tremendous worry, because had the conditions been propitious, there could have been a return to capitalism. Not a return, because they were not really very capitalist in the first place. But there was that stage of development. And I remember when I was developing politically, in the communists particularly, there was this view of stages. Oh, we have to go to capitalism before we go to socialism, they used to say to me. And therefore they were justifying everything, the bureaucracy and the Stalin bureaucracy was all the horrors of Stalin. They were whitewashing, because perhaps we'll need to go to capitalism before we go to feudalism. As a matter of fact, what Trotsky analyzes here is the factors that made it that was not the case, and that what developed was a stage in which the bureaucracy was at the same time it was afraid. It was because it had taken power from the masses, so it was afraid of the masses. So it would be very exercised to counter what they call the gossips. When people obviously were opposed, the Russian masses were opposed, the working class were opposed to all this, and so there would be people talking not very loud, because otherwise you could be repressed or eventually exiled or killed or something. So Molotov called that gossips, but that was because that bureaucracy feared the masses. It fears the masses. And at the same time, as it opposes the masses and develop its own inequality, its apparatus of inequality, it reinforces itself from putting the masses down. But I think, as has just been said, eventually it was in that very process that forces were growing, which were dangerous to the bureaucracy, because then then come the point where perhaps bureaucracy can no longer put everybody down. And I think this is important, because there we answer the question of whether there is a risk of going back to capitalism or going to capitalism. And I think this is one of the analysis which demonstrates that this is not the case, and that as the revolution, in my opinion, as the revolution has extended in the world, this is even more less likely now, and there is bound to be a regeneration, a diminution of the power of the bureaucracy on the whole. Yeah. That's it. I finished.
Sure. Who else wants to speak?
They used to applaud it themselves, didn't they, in Russia?
In Russia, yes.
I'm applauding myself.
Who wants to speak on this? I mean, I'm going to come back in a minute on a couple of points, because I think I'll come back anyway. I think my presentation is okay, but I think the there is a theoretical point in this which is somewhat lost in the last section, I think, which is Trotsky does actually explain very briefly what the issue is in Thermidor. But actually, Thermidor is a very limited analogy, isn't it? Because Trotsky actually does make the point is that in the French Revolution, Thermidor was obvious that it would happen, that what would that basically the French Revolution was a bourgeois revolution, and its historical import was to put the bourgeoisie in power, but its means of actually doing so was a radical petty bourgeois democratic movement, and it was inevitable at some point that that radical petty bourgeois democratic movement would go into some decline and a collaborate and decline in such a way that it's corresponded to the interests of the bourgeoisie itself, which was the core of the new society, the core ruling class, you know. Whereas in Russia, you had a proletarian revolution, and you had something that superficially is, you can make an analogy, as Trotsky did, and it was a very difficult thing to actually elaborate the analogy between Thermidor as that step backwards in the French Revolution and the step backwards in the Russian Revolution. But it was actually a different kind of revolution, and its historical objective was to bring the different class to power and to actually abolish class society, actually, you know. So the achievement of socialism leads to the abolition of class society, except that Russia was phenomenally backward, even in capitalist terms, at the time the working class took power, which created this excruciating contradiction because it had the most advanced property relations of all in the world, at the same time as its productive capacity was below those of its enemies, its main enemies in the world, which was the main imperialists. So the expression of that contradiction was, in order to regulate the backwardness of the productive forces through the advanced property relations that it was adopting, you had to have something to maintain a degree of inequality to allow the economy to function at that productive level, you know. And therefore, that's where the bureaucracy comes from. The bureaucracy comes from that contradiction, and it arises to maintain that level of inequality. And of course, if you have an apparatus to maintain a level of inequality, the danger is that it can become powerful in its own right and seize power off the proletariat politically. And you get an anomalous situation where the bureaucratic apparatus has politically expropriated the working class from power, you know, because there is a possibility of capitalist restoration. It does flow from that, is that if the bureaucracy is a bourgeois organ in a workers' state, therefore, its purpose is to maintain inequality, it can, in certain circumstances, rot away the socialist foundations of the revolution and provide itself as a Trojan horse for capitalist restoration in some form. That's historically possible. And that is what happened, in my opinion. You know, I think that I disagree with Marie that the revolution still exists in the form that certainly it did when the working class took power. But I think what happened is that capitalism that was restored is a crippled capitalism. It's a capitalism that's not fully able to do what capitalism is supposed to do. It's marred by decades of a non-capitalist economic development in that contradiction, you know. And therefore, it really is capable, you know, it's unstable, and it's capable of reverting back to, you know, relatively easily and comparatively. This is why the imperialists fear Russia even today. They fear Russia, they fear China, because even though a great deal of capitalist norms have been established or re-established, it's not stable. It doesn't have their confidence that it can that it's nailed down and will stay like that, you know. So I think it is a rather unusual. It's rather a difficult theoretical question to grasp, which is why so many people on the left have evaded it and gone in for theories of state capitalism and all this sort of thing, which really doesn't capture what's going on either, you know, because you end up defining Russia as imperialist and being something fundamentally the same as the US, which is obviously not true, you know. So it's a difficult concept. It's a workers' state with huge bourgeois deformations, right? Bureaucratic defamations are a form of bourgeois defamation of the worker's state, caused by its backwardness, really, by its lack of productive capacity compared to the imperialists, who are its main enemies, its main threat. But the contradiction is that now that capitalism has been restored, the capitalism that's been restored is enormously deformed in its own right by decades of non-capitalist development. So it's also anomalous. I think that's something that takes that is quite complex to understand. And in some ways, we are facing a situation a bit like the 19th century after the bourgeois revolutions, where the bourgeois revolution still sort of existed, but in a way that was not very, very clear. And you had all sorts of part movements, and you had the emergence of the proletarian revolution in the Paris Commune, and earlier actually in 1848 in embryo. There's a lot of complexity in this. That's my view. But I know that Paul wants to speak, so I'm going to stop rabbiting on and let Paul speak. Paul.
I'd actually change my mind because that when I put my hand down. But I will say something about the economy today in this country. It seems to me that talking about capitalism and feudalism, yes, we're not. This is interesting because obviously I've had various conversations with Maori and other comrades about, there is this theory that Gorky talks about where whenever there's a retreat, it doesn't actually go back to the original form. It's just that some of the old system comes back in a different form. So if we take capitalism today, what's left of it, and the old system of feudalism, it does now feel to me that in this country, particularly in England, that we are sort of moving back to some sort of semi-feudalism, because it seems to me that the only people that are really making all the money is those that own all the land and property, because more and more of the working class are basically earning so little in terms of wages that they don't have the purchasing power. So, in a sense, the capitalism is basically destroying itself and moving to some form of semi-feudalism. But anyway, that goes away a bit from the tech, but it's a way of explaining that, one sort of system comes into retreat, an old system can sort of come back, but it doesn't come back in quite the same form. But I think the argument that we're now living in a sort of semi-feudal country might seem controversial, but I think that's currently where we're heading to, in my own opinion, unless we continue to fight against it, of course.
John, are you going to say something? No? Just on that, I mean, Marie wants to speak,
No, I was saying, well done, Paul.
yeah? I think that it's not that we're heading back to feudalism. I think it's that the bourgeoisie is behaving more like the feudal aristocracy in its last days. It's becoming more and more venal and more self-entitled, and it believes it can do what it likes in a very, very arbitrary manner. And in that sense, it does actually resemble the feudal regime, the feudal aristocracy. I think the land is important, but even in countries where the land has been more obviously in this country, the aristocracy was never completely abolished. It was absorbed into the bourgeoisie. through things, yeah, the whole shebang of the Glorious Revolution and Cromwell obviously attempted to abolish the monarchy by beheading the king, but the king came back, the bourgeoisie allowed the king back and made a compromise with the aristocracy, which eventually led to the aristocracy being absorbed into a slightly modified bourgeoisie. And that is part of Britain. But even in countries where that's not true, the bourgeoisie is behaving in an incredibly arrogant, feudal type, in a manner that resembles the arrogance of the old aristocracy. You look at countries like France, and it's now says it's going to send troops to Ukraine. You think, what the flaming hell? This is the same mentality, really. It's the same arrogance that they think they have the right to. Yeah, exactly. It says it's semi-feudal. It's not really feudal. It's bourgeois, but it's behaving like a feudal regime because the feudal aristocracy was not always like that either. Except at the very end. At the end of its regime, it became incredibly self-satisfied and believed it was entitled to rule. Against everybody, and it ended up being chopped. And I think the bourgeoisie is in the position where, if the masses get their act together under the leadership of some sort of socialist movement, they could get chopped as well because they're behaving in the same way. And that's how ruling classes that are in deep decline actually tend to behave, I think, So yeah, there is a resemblance, But it really is the resemblance of the decay of another economic system, Albeit there are, yeah, exactly. That is the point. What Susan just said about the ruling elitists always end up believing in their own divine right to rule. I think that's true, Who else wants to speak?
Can I ask a question?
Certainly, yes. And Paul wants to speak, actually.
All right, let Paul
And I'll
speak.
let you in immediately afterwards.
I mean, the reason I use the term semi-feudal, because I'm not suggesting for 1 minute we're all going to go back to the original crop rotation system where everything is based on kings and actual farmland. That's not going to happen, but I am suggesting that the way our economy is, where everything is more condensed into sort of private ownership of land, and the fact that more, the middle class is actually being squeezed to the point where all the wealth it got to such a point where even those that were considered increasingly wealthy are now getting desperate because their wealth is disappearing. Because, as I say, I do argue that these days a lot of the people that are getting rich at the moment are those that own the land and property, hence why I use the term semi-feudal. I'm not suggesting that it will go back to the feudal system or feudal codes, but the model is kind of there, and that's what I'm saying. So,
Fair enough.
but yeah, I don't believe capitalism, as we know it, can survive, in the way that it has done. So that's why there's a constant need for more imperialist wars in the world, and it is. So that's why I insist that we are sort of going to a semi-feudal system. But I'm not suggesting for 1 minute it's going to be like the old feudal system, but capitalism clearly isn't going to survive in its current form, and something's got to give. And I think we're now reaching that stage, and it's a case of which direction is it going to go in, because nothing Nothing is written for us, is it? We've got to rewrite that history and continue to fight not only for the country that we want, but the world we want. And it's not written for us, is it? It's not a foregone conclusion. That's what I'm trying to say. Thanks.
Cheers. Marie, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, my question is, I mean, unless somebody else want to has to, an intervention to make. No?
No, I don't think so.
Not for the moment. When I did not completely follow when it spoke about the wages were equalized. I take it that must have been in 1917, 18. Interestedness of each worker diminished, and this put a brake on the development of the productive forces. So do I take to think that Trotsky would have been for the continuation of wage inequality after the revolution? And I've got another question attached to that one. Then could it be that in future, when we will not start from such abject underdevelopment, these questions probably will not be posed, and it will be much easier to stop or to hinder the development of bureaucracy?
Yeah.
Can
Paul.
I end? Yeah, I wanted to sort of see if I could answer that in some way. I mean, I might be completely wrong, but in terms of equalization of wages and whether it hampers the development, is Trotsky coming out? I'm guessing that Trotsky is suggesting, for the time being at least, the regime does need to maintain an element of capitalism in order to keep up a store of wealth so that you can eventually move towards socialism and therefore communism. But without the initial wealth that to build up in the first place, there would be nothing to redistribute. Or I think that's where he's coming from. I could be wrong. Ian will correct me on that, of course.
I think you're
But
basically
I
right.
go on.
Yeah, I think you're basically right. I mean, what he was talking about was a situation where, yeah, the state was imposing equality on the working class, obviously with a great deal of support. But in the end, the productive, the actual productivity of labour was so low that in order to improve it, it proved necessary to have a degree of inequality among the workers, because otherwise, there was very little interest in what was being produced. The what actually happened is that in various stages during NEP and later during the 30s, where the regime actually also retreated from administrative imposition of relative, administrative egalitarianism, right? You've got a situation where the growth, a limited growth of the productive forces, led to more inequality because the growth of wealth was only on the level that it couldn't really satisfy everybody. It could satisfy a minority of the population, and it did so, But in order to get to the stage where you can manipulate, where you can satisfy the majority of the population and abolish the need for inequality altogether, you have to have that development of the productive forces. And that's the contradiction, because the regime was too backward to build socialism, Because R Russia was the weak link in the imperialist chain. It was the weakest of all the imperial powers in a capitalist sense. Russia was an imperial country. You could argue, in a free capitalist sense, it was a great empire. But in capitalist terms, it was very, very backward in 1917. It was the most backward power in Europe. Probably not as backward as Turkey, but it was pretty backward, And as a result, Once the bourgeois, once the proletariat came to power, it had to find ways of developing the productive forces up to the level of its competitors, of its imperialist opponents. You know, and if it didn't do that, it was sunk. You know, it would be defeated. But if it did do that, it would lead to the growth of inequality within that framework. And again, the only cure for this is the international revolution. You know, within the national framework of Russia, any attempt to develop the productive forces over a period of time without aid from elsewhere would lead to the growth of inequality. And then that Trotsky was quite right. He was analyzing it from the point of view of the Stalin regime and what was driving you know this growth of inequality. You know, it was in the end the result of the program of socialism in one country. You know, and that suffuses the book really. You know, the whole book. You know, I mean, you can examine individual parts of it, but that is the overall theme of the book, is that really the only solution is the international revolution. We'll go through it and we'll discuss that in more depth in terms of a direct relationship to the text, I think, in chapters that are coming up, you know. Does that answer the question? I don't know.
I think so.
Good, good, good. Is there anybody else who wants to speak on this? Because I think it is sort of. What should we do? I mean, just in terms of the future of the study of the book, the next chapter is about the growth of inequality, and it's in four parts, and it really is. It talks in more detail about the growth of inequality amongst the workers, amongst collective farmers, and about the growth of the bureaucracy in general. And I suggest we do it as one piece. You know, it's quite a substantial chapter. But it isn't a theoretically substantial chapter. And I think we can probably do it as one class in a couple of weeks' time if people would be happy with that. You know, but it, you know, I think this one has got theoretically, you know, the three parts of it are theoretically distinct. I'm not so sure that the next chapter is quite like that, you know. Sorry, Susan wanted to say something, perhaps. Just a suggestion, anyway.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm trying to rest my voice a bit. I wonder the extent to which the Russian Revolution was also undermined by the industrialization of the weapons of war that, you know, because the Russian Revolution was not the country which it had expected to be where the revolution would start. In other words, it was not the most industrialized. And therefore, the struggle that it had was down to not being sufficiently self-sufficient. But both Russia and China ran into problems when they tried to industrialize too fast. However, what the imperialist countries of, you know, France and Britain and Germany had on their side was that because they were industrialized, they were ready with the mass weapons of destruction that made both Russia and China vulnerable until the time when Russia's massive resources, Russia is the biggest country by land mass and has the most resources and therefore has the opportunity to be self-sufficient. China had the population, which no amount of horrendous, you know, mass genocide, whether it was by Imperial Japan or whether it was by imperialist Britain and France and America, was able to dent what was then the most populous country. And therefore, you know, we're never comparing like with like. I mean, you know, the war that the imperialists carried out against Russia, trying to get hold of the resources, was defeated as much by Russia's land mass and the fact that the imperialists always had to take the war onto their land to fight them, which basically logistics destroyed them as much as anything else. And that was true, whether it was the imperialism of Bonaparte, you know, all of these military leaders and the militarism that propped up the monarchy in Britain, propped up the empire in France, and propped up, you know, it was the militarization. Whereas America, just like a vulture capitalist, leapt in to provide the weapons of war for both sides. And then when it decided which one had finally going to win and backed the winner and picked up the spoils, because everybody had to remilitarize and rearm after the war. But nobody's really talking about the part that financial levers were used against these countries, and in fact are still one of the major weapons. You know, the debt in society that brings countries down. And I'm surprised Trotsky doesn't ever mention the part. He talks about the bourgeoisie a lot, but he doesn't differentiate between the bankers and the military in terms of the enemies of socialism or the enemies of communism. So I've just got lots of questions about how Trotsky still seems to want to talk about these things without really tackling why, you know, what were the enemies of, you know, Soviet Russia? What were the enemies that did not allow communism to take root in the way that he wished it to develop? Okay. And so that's why I haven't said much, because it's the questions that won't stop popping up into my head to ask me, what is he addressing and what are the questions he's not addressing in these essays? Yeah. Sure. Anyway, thank you for being patient, and
no problem. Mm-hmm.
Apologies if I don't talk too much. It's just I've had too many Zooms, and as you can hear, my voice is going to go. Cheers. Thank you.
Yes. Paul.
Presumably, why Trotsky doesn't talk about, well, perhaps he will later on in the book, we'll find out, but if Trotsky hadn't said too much about finance or the military, presumably because he considered them part of the bourgeoisie. Well, that would be my response to that. Because they are part of the bourgeoisie, isn't it? You know, they're brought up with that ideology. And I think it's wrong to somehow separate it as two forms of different classes. I don't think it is necessarily a different class in as such. I think it's still part of the bourgeoisie, and therefore, you know, it's a different element, but it's still part of it. Personally, I think that's probably why he hadn't yet, at least not yet, mentioned the role of the military and finance capital. Because, I mean, in terms of finance, it just became another form of capitalism trying to maintain itself, isn't it? But yes, it's still part of the bourgeoisie. That would be my answer. I don't think it's necessarily separate.
Marie?
Yeah, I would like to have a go. trying to answer. I feel in some way that I understand some of what Suzanne is saying, so I'm going to have a try at looking into it. The first thing, of course, is that Trotsky is here in a period of his life where he knows he's going to be assassinated, and he knows why he's going to be assassinated, and he's explaining that he's not taking revenge on Stalin. He's just trying to understand how it could happen. Such a leadership could rise in something like a worker state. So I think that the remit of his intervention is rather different from that of Marx, who was making a historic analysis from of the class struggle from the point of view that the development of society is determined by the development in the means of production. And just to go back briefly to this question of the means of production, it is that the means of production develop because there is a scientific development in society. So scientific means that discoveries and new ways of accounting, and then education, the changes in education of a population. All these are conquests which come from inventions and innovations, and they are scientific. And the actual tactic of the creation of military means for pa forms part of the development of the economy and of production. Because in capitalism, it's all a question of winning the market. And so the origin of things is not militarism. It is the development of science and technology, which leads to a new means of military means and financial means. And there's many others like conquests and the means to propel oneself in other countries. The discovery of the engine was here in Britain. And so that makes a difference to the way who is going to invade who in the end. Just as one of the aspects, I think that the question of the means of production and their development should not be underestimated. And it is in comparison to them that one can foresee. You can foresee that a country which has developed a worker state is obviously necessarily has absorbed all sorts of scientific conclusions which come even from capitalism, because capitalism demonstrates that to produce for human need, you need to collectivize. This is what capitalism demonstrates, even though it doesn't propose it. And the collectivization, the idea of collectivization, is a scientific idea. Not military one. And now more and more it is the scientific which is important in every direction, less and less. The military is okay to actually go and smash somebody, but it is the social and the scientific preoccupation which builds society, not the military. Yeah. That's my go at it.
Sure. Anybody else? Anybody want to come back on that? Diana.
Ah, Diana Wells.
Yeah, I would question whether capitalism and the capitalist means of production, when it, as it was introduced in Britain, was actually producing for human need. It was producing for profit, and at the same time as it was using all the innovations that Marie mentioned, producing stuff and making profits. People had their land taken away from them, so their means of subsistence was removed, so they couldn't eat well, and they lived quite squalid lives without their needs catered for. The what enabled the capitalists to invest in new means of production in Britain was the capital they'd made from looting other countries, from looting the colonies. I'll give up there.
Anybody else?
When are you dating this from, Diana?
From where am I dating it from? Over the last the period covering the last 500 years.
Right, okay. You see, yeah, there's this problem with, again, it's sort of random chance. Yeah, I mean, Britain, if you want, or England's population, England and Wales population, was reduced by between a third and a half after the Black Death, and that completely changed the relationship between in within society in terms of the rights of workers, the 1350s, and that in turn resulted in, the concept of freemen, of skills, of workers being more valuable because they had certain skills and certain things that cities and bankers wanted. You had the enclosures, you had the rise of sheep, and you're right about the capitalism in terms that, the complaint of the common people was that sheep made more profit for them than people, than the food they could grow. So they wanted sheep on the land and they didn't care, they threw the people off. This business of how the ruling elite have seen people as just property, pawns to be increased or decreased by, misuse of their access to food and the ability to survive is very long term. But you've also got the problem with, as you say, colonialism, that people could go as the world opened up, as we circumnavigated the planet, as we gained the technology that allowed people to go out to other places. Yeah. People started, populations could increase, they could travel, they could go other places. And that in turn meant that people came back with fortunes, access to money that they wouldn't have had, that the ruling elite could not control as easily. So you've also got the issue with the church acquiring capital from people who wanted to buy their way to heaven and gave large donations to the church using power, yes, donating this divine right of kings, making, certain German emperors, if you like, the Holy Roman Empire, creating almost empires out of thin air. You had the rise of private military companies in regime change, and you can see it all the way across. That period from about 1300 to 1700 is an absolute maelstrom of different regimes coming up and down. And I think a lot of the time we're very much protected from it because we were an island. We were in the same position that America is now, protected by two oceans and convinced of its own invulnerability because it will never be nuked, because it can't imagine any other country having the weapons or the firepower to invade it or destroy it. And of course, it's that hubris that will bring them down in the same way that it brought the British Empire down, post World War One. I just wonder, I see no sign of us finding our own history, yes, well enough to be able to really plot out how we got to where we are. And I really don't see that we really understand enough to be able to see how the world is going forward and how we are interacting with each other. Yeah. But I think we're trying to, we need better tools to understand what's happening.
Susan, what Susan says is very interesting. I'm going to just come back on this. I mean, I think that it would be useful if we could actually have some, if you could write something about this, because it might actually provoke a more wide-ranging discussion of some of the historical questions that you're raising, which I'm sure they're probably very useful, I think, because I mean I have read some stuff about ancient, about sort of, set not really modern history, sort of the history of the Middle Ages and the history of sort of the last 1,000 years or stuff by people, I can't remember the guy's name now. But there's a history of Europe by Norman somebody. What's his name? I can't remember his name.
Stone.
Norman Stone, yes.
Oh,
That was a
thank you, John.
very,
Yeah.
very interesting piece of stuff, a bit of, sort of narrative which sort of transcends some of the usual barriers as what's appear to be the more conventional divisions of Europe and things, he does go into the history of Poland and the history of Sweden and places like that that played, important roles in such events as the 30 Years' War and that, which people don't really know very much about, but they did
No.
play an important role in the formation of Europe as well, and maybe for some, if you want to write about that, I'd be very, it'd be very, very useful, I think. We want discussion material that can broaden out historical perspectives and things, so I think it's very interesting. And how it fits together with this, I'm not entirely sure, but I think it may well have significance. It's something to think about anyway, Sorry, John wanted to speak. Yeah.
Yeah, just about Susan's frustration there. I think, partly why we are where we are is because of the decline of the left, and having explanations for the way capitalism's developed and the discussions going on. And there's been, as I said to Ian, and I've said in this meeting before, there was a brain drain away from the left in the last period because of the defeat and whatever. And we've lost a lot of good people who can think about this stuff. I mean, that's why at the beginning I was asking about the size of these groups and that. And because there has been a drain away from, there has been a sort of going away from the left and the Marxist left, and that's why we're always grasping at trying to get an understanding of things, and but there's a very limited base on people discussing these things anymore in the way that we'd like. There's people discussing these things, exactly the things you're talking about, Susan, but then they're not on the Marxist left. So hopefully that will change in the next few years, and
So where are
we'll
they?
get we'll well, they're in academia, and then they're not on the Marxist left. They're on the, I suppose at one stage there was the postmodernists and
You see, I have a
that sort
horrible
of thing.
feeling that in the same way that the capitalists have driven Marx out of economics and political discussion in the universities, that they have also done exactly the same with the history and what I would call just general discussion. Yes, it's almost like it's like that horrible period in science in about the 1920s when people threw up their hands and said, all right, everything's been discovered. We're never going to find anything new. And then, of course, Einstein comes along and it all changes. But there was a time when people were saying exactly the same about the various branches of science, that we already knew it all. And of course, we don't. Sorry, Marie, I interrupted.
That's all right.
Yeah, the
Carry on. No, carry on, John.
no. I was just gonna say, just repeat my point, that socialist theory, for various reasons, not just the defeats and that, but
because of Stalinism and that, has taken knocks. And our thing of people to explain what's going on is, it has taken very much a back seat. Hopefully that won't last, but as I was saying at the beginning of the meeting, I was asking the size of groups and the thing. They're very small and the quality is quite poor, and that's a sign of various things that have happened to the Marxist movement over the past 40, 50 years, and that doesn't mean that there's still stuff being discussed. I mean, there's still some very useful contributions going on, but it will take time before that for that to build up.
Marie.
Yeah, a good point Jonathan made, I thought. I think that's true that there has been an enormous retreat on the level. For example, if you take No to NATO, that was created by Galloway and Williamson, they had in originally a good position, which was supporting the denouncing NATO and supporting Russia actually putting a stop to NATO, NATO's advance, NATO just rampaging eastwards. They used to have that position. They started that organization on that basis, and now they are not keeping it up. They are not maintaining it, which means that the position which we find in Stop the War and CND is not really properly tackled. And it seems to me it is an aspect of this, what John was saying. And another aspect of it is the fall of the Soviet Union. The actual implosion, or whatever you call it, means that a lot of confidence has been lost in people. A lot of people who would have, they were hoping for something better. They could see that Vietnam won, and many countries in Africa won because they got the support of the Soviet Union. Cuba triumphed because there was a Soviet Union. Even the Soviet Union was not doing enough. Nevertheless, the existence of the Soviet Union was blocking imperialism's advances. And so, yes, it's true there's been a retreat, but I think there is another aspect which is important, is to see that the history of the power of people is what should be interesting us, not the history of countries in abstract, what we call we, i.e. the country, which is the ruling class and the people. We is not the right way of designating a country or our country, because in there the history up to now has been written by those who are in power. And so it's very important to give to Trotsky his due, is that he's now taking up the defense of the right of the masses to take power and to keep it. And the question of the Soviets, the Soviets, what were the Soviets? They were not something special to Russians. Soviets was a committee where everybody could come, and they would decide in every locality the buses, the schools, the hospitals, the transport, and production. But that is hidden. The capitalist class doesn't want to talk about it. And if we do not give pride of place to Trotsky, we are in danger, perhaps ourselves, of not taking up, continuing the fight for the development and the success of the taking of power by people, what they call people's power, which means working class power, really. And so I think this is why this text is important, and everything to do with Trotsky is important, because he has given this to all his life. And this is what is the objective for anybody who wants socialism. This is what the aim must be. We want the masses, the people, the working class to rule, the people to rule. suppose I went.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's very good, actually. I think that's very true. I think we, the question of a retreat is not, it can't really be separated from the collapse of the Soviet Union and the failure to replace the communist movement by the Trotskyists. The Trotskyist movement really has not succeeded in creating a mass international communist movement yet. We have to keep struggling, obviously, but we haven't yet succeeded in doing that, and I think it's been very, very difficult because of the backwash from the decline and then the destruction of the USSR, and now we're in a different situation. But we have to reforge that movement, and it's not easy because there is a bit of loss of social power, really, the social power of being able to bring in the intellectuals and even the communist movement under Stalinist, under Stalinist degeneration had more social power than we did, and unfortunately it was not used for good purposes. But nevertheless, that power existed. It did actually produce byproducts that were quite creditable, intellectual movements and things around the Third International, which have of course been blown away largely, So yes, it will take time to rebuild that. I think that's very, very true. I think Jonathan is right on that. Susan, sorry, Susan wants to
All right.
speak.
Oh, no, that's all right. It was just to ask. Thanks to the vagaries of my history curriculum, I have a huge gap in the middle of my own history of Britain, which is the period between things like the English Civil War and the levellers and the diggers, and right the way through until you get to things like the abolition of slavery. Some of which is coming out now as the sort of interference. But are there any books that those of you who are going to be better read than me on this period can recommend on those things? Because I think that it seems to me that the levellers and diggers who were thrown out of the British, shall we say, revolution as was, from Cromwell through to the abolition of slavery, which came out of a genuine grassroots movement in England against the slave trade, that period has to have been formative for Marx and Engels to come out against capitalism. It must have shaped it. And are there any good, what I'd call socialist history books? Because at the moment, it's all, I'm sorry to say it, but it's all right wing, it's propaganda, most of it. You'd think that there was nothing to do with ordinary people. It's all about the knobs and snobs. Yeah. So is there anyone who can recommend me a few books on that? Or will I have to go back to the people who've gone back to the original tracts and writings of the time?
Marie.
Yeah, very briefly. I think that there are books, obviously, which are better than others for every epoch. But now is the epoch we are in, where we are in the war, which is a world war, and which doesn't threaten to become smaller. The books to read are those who show how to transform the war of the capitalists into a war to defeat them, as happened in 1917, 1918, when they turned the First World War into a revolutionary war. This is the things that we should be reading, I think.
Oh.
Yep.
To actually answer Susan's question, you could try. I haven't read it yet myself. I've only read bits of it, but you could try Chris Harman. People history of the world
Might be interesting.
But I haven't finished reading that myself, but I know Chris Harmon was SWP, but I always liked his writing style, and it was his writing that actually got me interested in Marxist politics and Marxist history. And I think that one that I've mentioned is the last book that he wrote before he died.
People's History of the World, yes?
Chris Harmon. But I haven't read it yet, so don't quote me. It's just something that if you want to know about I don't know what period he covered, but given by the title, I suggest it's probably quite a substantive book. I think it's about 600 pages, so I'm guessing he covers quite a large period. But yeah, that's my recommendation anyway.
Right. I might try and find it in hardback on eBay. I have a real problem with reading paperbacks because the paper contrast isn't enough.
Yeah.
I will thank you for steering me that way. Yep.
Sure. John.
Yes.
Just briefly, yeah, I mean, the best you can do is probably to ask people in the various groups, in the bigger groups, bigger Trotskyist groups, they'll recommend something. I don't know who that would be, but there's always someone who knows where to steer you. I mean,
can I ask a question?
Certainly. Yeah.
My question would be, why, what is the preoccupation behind wanting such a book? I would like to know what is motivating it.
What I'm trying to do is look at grassroots and Turan's messaging, by the way, on Facebook.
Right.
Ian, if you haven't seen it. It's more about why British and other revolutions, why each revolution is so different in each country. And how, because we've had a monarchy for so much of our, last millennia, whether that, constant propagandizing of church and monarchy and the class system is going to make us so much less willing to contemplate socialism or revolution at all. Yeah?
Yes. Thank you.
John, sorry, you wanted to say something again?
Just briefly on this thing of books and predictions and analysis and things. I mean, I remember reading a review of a Robin Blackburn book that came out on America, on slavery in America, right? And the reviewer said one of the interesting things is that Robin Blackburn said in this book was that one of the conclusions of the book was that Marx had been very overly optimistic in his writings about the development of a labor movement in America. So, this has all happened before, where we predict things and they don't turn out to be so. Maybe Robin Blackburn would be a good place to start.
Yeah, that's true, actually. The stuff by Perry Anderson on feudalism and the transition as well, which I don't know if it's exactly the, it really covers a lot of the same period. Whether it covers the same the stuff that you're really looking for is another question. But I think some of it might be useful. I read that stuff a very long time ago, that's the thing. And I can't remember that much about it.
If you want to actually buy books, one place, if you're not really bothered about whether they're new or second hand, One place I would recommend is abbook.com or .co.uk. I know AB Books is it's owned by Amazon and people get on their high horse. But the thing about abbook.com is you are actually buying from individual booksellers, so their business model is actually different to buying from Amazon. What happens?
Don't worry, Paul, I know them very well, and yes, I do regularly buy from them, not Amazon.
Right.
But I agree with you.
Right. Is there any more discussion on this? Should we go on just, I mean, any other business, really, if that's all right with people, yeah?